Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Bike share is back. Pronto failed in Seattle, but maybe it wasn't the hills and the rain. Maybe we just needed a different kind of bike share. And here it is. New this week, you will see two sets of bicycles, orange and lime green bicycles that are there for the taking. Need a bike? Take a bike. Drop a bike. We're going to give you a preview in about 20 minutes. First, though, we're going to begin this hour with the big news in Seattle. A city council member and some mayoral candidates are calling on Seattle's mayor to resign. The Seattle Times reported over the weekend that a child welfare investigator in Oregon concluded in the 1980s that Ed Murray sexually abused his foster son. The county prosecutor did not file a criminal charge, and Mayor Murray denies that and other allegations of sexual abuse. He is not running for re-election. I've been interviewing the leading candidates to replace Ed Murray, and today I'm with candidate, educator, attorney, artist, activist, boxer, Nikita Oliver. Good to see you again. Welcome back.
Good to see you as well. Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your campaign for mayor, why are you calling on the current mayor to resign when he denies the allegations and hasn't been through the courts?
You know, the findings in Oregon are actually an administrative law finding. And so it's important to recognize that there is a finding of at least a recognized type of due process. And I think it really comes down to accountability, but also the constant public rehashing of sexual abuse and violence that is incredibly re-traumatizing for a lot of people. I think even more so, it really is about accountability. It's about him acknowledging that at least the implications of the continued story, what that has upon the city and what it means for him to continue to have that on his plate as he's effectively leading our city. But honestly, my campaign has no interest in politicizing tragedy. And part of why we're answering the question is because media is asking, but also because it is important for our elected officials to be willing to speak up when something is out of sorts, instead of just simply protecting each other and being willing to admit when something seems like it might be wrong. And we need to really pursue accountability and protection, especially for those communities that most need access to services as they're dealing with sexual trauma and abuse and violence.
Okay, so just so listeners are clear, you mentioned the idea of this whole conversation being re-traumatizing for some people, a distraction. Are you assuming that Murray's consistent denials are a lie, or are you saying it's just a problem regardless of that judgment?
I'm not saying they're a lie. What I will say is there's been absolutely no acknowledgement of victims, no victims, not the ones who have alleged, but also of the many victims that actually live within our city. And that there's really what we should be doing is this should draw our attention as a city towards providing more services. And he's not even entered the conversation from that perspective. How do we see this as the bigger substantive issue that it is, and acknowledge that this should draw us towards looking at systems of accountability, but also looking at what services are we providing for community members that are struggling with the trauma of sexual violence and abuse?
Okay, final question on this subject. Councilmember Gonzalez actually gave Murray a deadline to resign, or else the city council should convene its own committee to study a transition in leadership, which sounds to me like impeachment. I just want to know, do you think Murray should be forced out of office?
I think that the city council should do its own investigation as a way of being a part of the checks and balances of our city, of ensuring that all of our leaders are being held to a particular standard of accountability, but more importantly, transparency. And I think the council sits in the position to provide that. I'm not going to comment on the deadline, but I do think it's important that given that these allegations have remained consistent and they are having an impact on the city, that the council do some sort of investigation of its own.
Okay. Now, on the subject of your campaign for mayor, which is why you're here, you were in a candidate's debate last night, which we aired live on KUOW. And during the debate, David tweeted on KUOW's Twitter page, David says, "I agree with many of their positions, but I have no sense of how will they prioritize when they can't accomplish them all. What is your top priority?"
Yeah, and I think that's an incredibly important question. Our top priorities are looking at the affordability crisis and the state of emergency around homelessness, and seeing how that is those two things are interconnected with each other, but they're also interconnected with development and transportation, as well as how do we help families become economically viable, both through having access to housing, community land trusts, what property allows families to become economically viable, but also access to jobs. I think the reality is we keep treating the issue of affordability as if it's siloed, as if it's separate from other issues in our city, and it's just simply not. So as we prioritize around the state of emergency of homelessness and the affordability crisis, I think it's important that we look at the root causes of poverty and understand that really a part of our long-term strategy is helping families overcome those root causes. And then we'll see less families that are moved into homelessness.
So you're saying it's not so much a bunch of priorities as it is these are interconnected.
Absolutely.
So then I'm talking with Nikita Oliver. How would Seattle be different if you were mayor as opposed to Ed Murray? What's that vision?
You know, the vision is about how do we pull from the margins and lift from the bottom of our city so that the whole of our city can be healthier. There are a lot of people that are being displaced, that are being pushed out, who for a myriad of reasons don't have access to jobs and opportunity and housing the way that they should. And I believe that education and housing are a human right. And it is really upon our leaders of the city to be providing a vision for what that looks like so we can have a healthier city, but also providing goals, metrics, looking at our budget and prioritizing our $5.6 billion budget towards achieving a healthier city. And I believe the way that we do that is by supporting the people at the margins and the people at the bottom. And when we pull and we lift, the whole of our city does better.
How do you think that $5.6 billion budget is being misspent now, if it is?
So we have a variety of priorities that I just do not think meet the goals of addressing the affordability crisis and the state of emergency around homelessness. One example, when we look at how we spend our funds, is looking at our criminal legal system. Seattle Municipal Court, in a lot of ways, criminalizes poverty when we look at low-level misdemeanors. One that we've heard in the community is that when people get on the light rail and they're not able to pay, you may get stopped by fare enforcement and get a ticket. So you go from paying $5 to ride to getting a ticket for $124. Now, if you couldn't pay the initial fee to get on, you certainly cannot pay the ticket. If you do that multiple times, eventually that can turn into a theft three that our court is then prosecuting people for being poor.
That what else could we do with
a waste
with
of light fiscal resources?
Okay. What else would we do about light rail free riders?
Yeah. So one of the things that we're wanting to do is make sure that young people under the age of 18 all receive a free ORCA card, and to ensure that also our elders and our seniors have access to those more amenities when it comes to public transportation, as a way of doing two things. One, not criminalizing poverty and recognizing that having access to public transportation, especially for our young people, is incredibly important. But two, building a culture of using public transportation within our younger generation so that as they get older and they have children, that becomes more likely. This is important for our city on an environmental level. This is important for our city as we further build out our transportation infrastructure and as we build affordable housing around that infrastructure to encourage the use of public transportation. So it's a multifaceted approach. It all goes back to our vision of not seeing any problem within our city as siloed, but understanding they're actually all incredibly interconnected. So we need solutions that are about systems integration, about making all of these systems lead towards a single vision of a healthier city.
I'm talking with Nikita Oliver, one of the leading candidates for the position of mayor of the city of Seattle. A listener named Clark said on Facebook, building more apartments is not the answer to affordable housing. It isn't a supply issue. Even when these new complexes open, they are still priced through the roof. Is affordable housing in Seattle, is it an issue of supply?
It is partly an issue of supply and partly an issue of market. One of the problems that I foresee in terms of how we've been addressing the affordability crisis is we have been relying upon the private market as the answer to that. That's part of the reason why with MHA, which is one of the 65 recommendations in HALA, asking for 2 to 11% affordable housing. One, it's not enough, but two, it It's asking developers to invest in affordable housing. It's just simply not enough in terms of percentage, but it's also not enough in terms of our market. So we really need a multifaceted strategy that also looks at building public housing strategically. We can't just build it anywhere. We need to build it around our infill stations that we'll be having with the light rail and around places where we know transportation is robust. But the third thing is we need market intervention strategies, because I think this listener is correct. Our market consistently goes up and our definition of affordable doesn't adjust as that market goes up. As we say, the average median income each year it increases, so then 30 to 60% increases, but those income gains are not shared across populations. So when I speak about market intervention, I'm thinking about speculators. We have a huge speculation market that is driving the cost of housing up, and as a result, I think we need a speculator tax as a way of decreasing that behavior, but also a way to fund public housing by actually deterring the behavior, but also then saying, you know, speculators are going to be an inevitability in our market, so they might as well be contributing to our affordable housing plan.
Speculators meaning people who don't live in the property they're buying.
Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned public housing. Also during last night's mayoral debate, a different David tweeted, "I support affordable housing, but all I hear about is public housing. How will you pay for it while middle class is priced out?"
I believe that our public housing infrastructure also has to serve our middle class, our working class families. And public housing cannot just be about building public housing buildings and units. It's also got to be about community land trust. I think the city has to get in the business of buying land and then allowing families, inviting them to have homes on those pieces of land as a way of building their economic viability. Affordability is not just about having an affordable place to live. It's also about having the ability to make yourself economically sustainable, both by owning property, but also having access to high earner jobs. And so we need to, alongside building housing and building housing opportunities, we need to be building pipelines into jobs. And we have a robust industry, a tech industry. We have a maritime industry. We need to be finding ways to ensure that our young people who live here now have access to those jobs when they graduate from high school, when they finish college, as a way of ensuring the economic viability of our middle class and our low-income families.
So speculator tax, ask more of developers, require more of developers. Who else pays more if Seattle's new income tax doesn't hold up in the courts?
You know, we have to be committed to pursuing a transformation of our incredibly regressive tax structure. With property taxes and sales taxes, we are saying that those who earn less actually have to pay more. I believe that we're going to, in the next few years, be able to get this progressive income tax through. One, based on the heart of Seattle, I think a lot of our high earners want to invest more. And honestly, the legislation actually asks for a very limited amount on high earners above $250,000. The second thing is we're one of seven states that have this sort of upside down tax structure. So there is a lot of analogous law in other states that I think will be very moving for the courts, because the case that we're fighting is from the 1930s. And so I think that we have a high likelihood of it moving forward. If it doesn't, we do need to look at other means of taxation to begin to bring down these incredibly regressive taxes. I think when we think about building out our city, impact fees are going to be incredibly important. I think we can ask more of our corporations with a corporate head tax. And then we need to look at our small businesses. How do we make these taxes that we put in place in impact business progressive as well, to ensure that our small businesses don't take hard hits the same way that our low-income families, we don't want them to take hard hits.
Nikita Oliver, educator, attorney, artist, activist, and running for mayor of Seattle. You have said that Seattle's historically black central district needs to be a centralized space where young people of color can find support from people who look like them and who understand their place in society. Seattle neighborhoods have always turned over and changed. Rainier Valley used to be Italian. Why try to freeze one neighborhood's racial identity in time?
I think that when I talk about the Central District, and to be honest, not too many black folks live in the Central District anymore,
right,
is that in a lot of ways it's become a space where we can see the cultural capital that black folks have contributed to the city, and yet we don't get access to it. I don't know if we can turn that around. But what I do know is when we look at areas like the Chinatown International District, we do not have to make the same mistakes that we've made in the Central District or that we seem like we're beginning to make in the Rainier Beach area. What we can do is put in place anti-displacement strategies by investing in affordable commercial spaces for local businesses, by investing in community land trusts that we put in the hands of trusted nonprofits that are already existing in the Central area, by relying upon the community voice to direct us in what it looks like for that area to be developed. It's important not just about the cultural identity of young people being able to continue to have access to that, but it is also about being willing to preserve the cultural identities that have made our city economically viable. People want to be in Seattle because of the things that Native peoples, that Black peoples, that the API community have contributed here, and we build relics to it all over the city. We need to make sure that the cultures and communities that have contributed to that still have access to that in those spaces.
Speaking, you're broadening it from racial identity and values to cultural values. Mm-hmm. On the subject of race, you helped Macklemore write the song White Privilege too?
I did help in the writing and development of that.
What did you contribute?
So I met Ben right after...
Ben Haggerty, Macklemore.
Macklemore, yes. Mm-hmm. Right after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson. We were involved in a number of demonstrations, and he had contacted me through Hollis Wongware saying that he wanted to find ways to connect in particular with Black organizers so that he could act accountably as a white ally. And so we first started just by having a lot of long conversations about what is white privilege, how do you leverage it as a way of creating systems transformation and change, what does an ally really look like, what does an accomplice look like as we're trying to make big transformation through movements like Black Lives Matter when we think about things like liberation. And so we started doing some projects together, and he came to me one day and said, hey, will you meet me at a coffee shop? And we actually ended up sitting in his Cadillac, and he played a track for me and rapped for me the first few verses he had originally written. And I said, a few of those verses are a little bit off. I don't know if you want to put that out into the world yet. And so literally for about 14 months, we would meet once a month for a few hours.
What did he rap that didn't make it into the song?
I cannot say.
Okay.
But it really was a process of Ben and really the whole team that contributed to it, because there were other artists on board, finding ways to communicate the ways in which white folks can be a part of Black Lives Matter in a way that's accountable, but also leverages white privilege as a way to talk about what we were seeing when it comes to police brutality and police accountability.
Well, what did you think of some of the blowback he got for patting himself awfully hard on the back?
You know, I, as someone who's now found myself in the media a lot, I recognize that sometimes the stories that get told are not entirely accurate. And I think Ben tried very hard to work very closely with especially Black organizers and Black artists so that it wasn't a pat on the back. I think no matter what direction he went, if he didn't say anything, people were going to call him out for saying something. People were going to call him out. And so I think what he did was he set an example of taking a bold step and then taking the blowback, accepting that that is a part of accountability. It's a part of transparency. It's also a part of us growing and transforming as we try to transform the world around us.
So he took some punches.
He did.
Speaking of which, I opened this conversation saying you're an educator, attorney, artist, activist, candidate, boxer. What'd you learn from boxing? Who's your favorite boxer?
Who's my favorite boxer? I mean, I think that's easy. Muhammad Ali. I love boxing at Arcaro Boxing over on 12th and Jefferson. And what I love most about it is you learn about yourself. You might think you get into the ring and you're fighting your opponent, but reality is your biggest enemy in the ring will always be you. And so over the past few years of training, what I've really learned to do is to always turn any question I have or any fear I have or any critique I have back on myself first as a way of grounding myself and being a better person. And so there's something about taking a punch that makes you have to think about yourself. But also, if you're going to punch someone, you had better be willing to take one. And so, especially as I think about the mayor's race and the many times I get asked for comment, I think twice. And it's really based upon my practice as a boxer of understanding that strategy and your willingness to take a hit all ultimately will determine how you do in the ring. But even more than that is your discipline, your commitment outside of the ring to be constantly training. All fights are really won outside the ring before you ever step in there.
Not just a boxer, but an activist, a poet, an attorney, an educator, and one of the leading candidates to be the mayor of the booming city of Seattle. Nikita Oliver, thanks for this time together.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I mentioned a couple of times listeners who tweeted in during that mayoral debate that you might have heard live last night on KUOW. In case you missed it, we're going to have Ross Reynolds come in and tell you what you missed and talk about bike share being back and other stuff too this hour. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. As I mentioned, the leading candidates for Seattle's mayoral race met last night on stage for their only televised debate. Maybe you heard the audio here on KUOW. Ross Reynolds had the job of co-moderating and trying to get six politicians to say something interesting. Ross Reynolds, how'd you do?
Well, I'll leave that up to the listeners and the viewers and how I did. I certainly felt as though I got something out of it. At a bare minimum, we were able to ask all the candidates what they felt about the call for Mayor Murray to resign. And we found out that almost all of them did. The only two exceptions, Jenny Durkin, who was endorsed, of course, by Mayor Murray, and also State Senator Bob Hasegawa, wouldn't go that far. So we did begin to see some differences. When we think of the six candidates on stage, if you watched it, I kind of categorized them as if going from left to right. Indeed, on the left, I would include Nikita and Bob Hasegawa as kind of probably the most leftist candidates, and partly because Bob Hasegawa, in response to a question about why are we doing so poorly on homelessness, said, it immediately went to the class question. He said it's because the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And you certainly just heard from Nikita why you might put her there. The next category would be the people who are activists in some way, and certainly Carrie Moon falls into that category. And we've got the elected officials. I think Jenny Durkin and Mayor McGinn has had the job. Jenny Durkin is kind of an establishment figure. They're also in a different category. So we were able to kind of parse those out. But frankly, there was something of a word cloud when they got into the issues. It's a little hard to kind of draw them down, and I would partially fault myself for that. What I really wished I had talked about or gotten them to answer was, as you heard from Nikita and you've heard from the other candidates, they have a lot of big ideas for let's spend money to do this to solve this problem. We hear very less about what will the outcomes of us doing that be. Okay, if we do that, what can you promise us will happen because of that? For example, are you going to cut homelessness in half? Are you going to house X number of people? What will occur because you say this good thing will happen?
It's something measurable?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think they should put themselves on the line that way to make a commitment. I could see why you wouldn't. If I was someone making a promise about what I would do with homelessness, we know from the King County 10-year plan to end homelessness, which ended with homelessness even worse, it's difficult and hard to make promises. But part of me yearned for them to be a little bit more definitive. You're saying these will do good things. Tell us how much good they'll do and be precise.
Yeah, another example comes to mind is the climate change promises. And then we're learning about, Seattle hasn't actually met the goals that were so loftily promised.
Exactly.
So what about the big news of recent days with the Seattle passing an income tax? That is national news.
Yeah.
And I assume they all weighed in on the income tax?
They all weighed in favor of the income tax. Jenny Durkin was, she wasn't quoted. I asked her about this, but in the Seattle Times endorsement, there's some verbiage about her saying this costly court battle they're have to go through to get this finalized would be a waste of money. So I asked her about that, and she said those were the Seattle Times words, not my words, but they were in her endorsement. Mm. But no, they were all solidly on board with the idea of an income tax. But of course, that even raises more questions. As you've pointed out, when will that come online? You can't really count on it. How much will the court battle cost? And then once, if they are able to get that through, where are you going to spend the money? It's supposed to go to reduce regressive taxes. But are there other things that it could go for? I think if it does clear a court challenge, whoever's mayor will have some discretion there to work with the council on how the money would be spent.
Well, you certainly experienced last night what our listeners have experienced, and I experienced the last several days in talking to six of the leading candidates. There's a lot of agreement. Did we hear useful disagreement that would help voters choose among these candidates?
You're right. It's very narrow. I mean, they are pretty much all on one side of the political spectrum. I think that there are some in Seattle who want us to be more fiscally conservative. They feel as though we're spending too much money. They feel as though the door is way too wide open for taxation, including the high earner income tax. However, of all the candidates, Mike McGinn, and I can't say this categorically, but he did talk about there being too much spending in city government. He talked about bloat in city government, and he even gave a figure. He said $30 to $40 million that he could cut from the city budget. Now, I asked him to be more precise about it, and he has talked about the mayor's office itself has grown the budget enormously, but that ain't $30 to $40 million. Mm-hmm. And so I was not able to kind of pin down the candidates to, okay, if you say there's waste there, where exactly would you look and how much money would you come up with? So we have Mike McGinn on record with $30 to $40 million. We'll see if he can actually deliver on that, should he clear the field.
There was a poll, a KUOW King 5 poll, showing Mike McGinn and Jenny Durkin in the lead.
Yeah.
Did this debate do anything to upset that apple cart, do you think?
We don't really know yet. I mean, I think there's been some internal polling since that by some of the campaigns, but we don't know what was in that internal polling. So it's what is going to happen on August 1st when all the votes are tallied. I think that there'd be a major upset if neither Jenny Durkin nor former Mayor Mike McGinn cleared the field in the primary. I think that would be a major upset. Nikita Oliver, who was third, could possibly be moving up. We don't really know because there isn't any precise polling going on. And with 38% undecided in that poll, who knows? How did they receive that information last night? And as we both know, we'd like to think that everybody focused on issues, but partly they were just looking at how they presented themselves, how they looked, how they sounded, beyond the ideas that they had. So it's really impossible to predict.
Yeah, and I really try not to go too far into punditry. It just is interesting how many candidates there are and therefore how few votes this can really come down to when it comes to someone taking off a piece of that votership and making it through to the primary.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we just talked to the top six. The rest of them will get some votes. It'll be tiny percentages, but those will add up, and it could be someone who will get into the general election with a very small percentage of the overall vote.
KUOW's Ross Reynolds doing us all the great public service and pressing the top Seattle mayoral candidates to give up their talking points and get at it among one another. Tell you why you ought to use a black ink pen to completely fill in the oval next to their name on your August 1st primary ballot. Ross, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. Now, let's talk about something that has been a big city issue. You know, when we talk about Seattle and bike share, we talk about it failing. Remember, Pronto. What are we going to do with Pronto? Do we rescue it? Do we expand it? Oh, it's collapsed. But Gabriel Scheer and Derek Coe are not giving up on bike share. They look at Seattle and its hills and rainy weather and bad drivers. They look at all of that and they see dollar signs and they see a chance to make the city easier to get around. They are both betting that private bike share companies are going to make it in Seattle because Gabriel Scheer is the director of strategic development for Lime Bike and Derek Coe is the co-founder and CEO of Spin. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks
Good
for
to
having
be
us.
I want to start our conversation with a comment from one of our listeners. Ben says, there's already a significant bike culture here, and the relatively low cost of a bicycle makes the barrier to ownership low. Most of the Pronto users I saw were tourists with looks of regret on their faces as they lugged heavy bikes up hills. So Ben wants to know, who are these new bike share systems for? If you want a bike, you have a bike, right? Or not?
Yes. I think that's a great question. I'll speak as somebody who owns a bike and rides it every day here in Seattle specifically. And for me, I was a member of Pronto from the beginning and re-upped my membership. And the way I used Pronto was often in the middle of the day. It would be easier to take it to a meeting if I was, for example, working in sort of the Midtown area and I had a meeting in Pioneer Square or a lunch somewhere or something like that. I would use it like that. I would also imagine it being kind of a first last mile solution. So if you imagine light rail, Columbia City or Othello or something, people right now might be taking a 3/4 mile to a 1.25 mile drive to that station, and that's causing more congestion, more cars on the streets. I would imagine some people supplanting that with a bike-based trip, which are people who live here in town. I think tourists, sure, that's definitely one. And you know, one of the things you saw with Pronto was you could rack up a fairly large bill over the course of a few hours because you didn't return it in the 30 minutes. And with ours, and I know Spin as well, you know, it's 30 minutes equals $1, and you just keep doing that. And so while it doesn't necessarily work for everyone, the costs will be considerably lower, I think.
Derek Coe of Spin, do you have any more thoughts on why Pronto bike share failed in this town?
Part of it is definitely due to the station-based model. And
everybody doesn't know, so yeah, what's the station-based model and what's your alternative?
Yeah, so station-based model is what you saw with Pronto, where you got to pick up a bike from a station and drop it off at a station. But like you would take a bus, you have to know the schedules, you have to know where to pick it up and where you get dropped off. spin and likewise line bike are stationless in that you can pick up a bike anywhere through mobile apps, scan it, drop it off anywhere where it's legal to park a bike. Like yesterday, I was traveling from around Belltown down to City Hall for the Bike Advisory Council meeting, and I was in a car.
It's your first mistake.
Yes. And this was at like 5:30. If I had a spin bike, I'll just take it, pick it up, ride it down, and just leave and not have to worry about where I where the stations are or where I would have to park the bike.
Okay, is Lime Bike and Spin, these are two kind of contestants in the new space of bike share, are you doing basically the same thing, exactly the same thing?
We are doing very much the same thing with a similar model. There are differences in terms of the types of bikes we're using, how they're built, the gearing. You know, we have an eight-speed gear on our bikes. It's an in-hub shifter. So we've done things a little differently that way, and that's a bike we built specifically for Seattle. So we've launched in four other cities now, and those four other cities don't have that eight-speed. We did that specifically because of the hills here. Again, I ride on those hills every day, so I'm very familiar with the effort it takes. I think from a pricing model perspective, we're doing very much the same thing. And I think that the thing that is exciting to me about all this is Pronto had 500 bikes at its peak. And between the two of us, we're required to launch with around 500 bikes from the get-go. So already we're doubling what Pronto had ever. And the thing that's really cool about that, Derek kind of touched on this, but if you imagine Pronto when it was basically South Lake Union, the U District, Little East Lake, Little Capitol Hill, and downtown, let's say you wanted to go to Ballard. You can't. There's no station there. So you hop on a bike and you're stuck. So people wouldn't use it, right? And it wasn't a viable alternative to other means. So to Derek's point, hop in a car, hop on a bus if you can get a bus from where you're going to and from, but those still get stuck in traffic. And what this allows both of us to do is free that, right? Let people ride wherever.
If there's no station to return the bike to, are we just hoping that the users return the bikes to responsible places and, you know, get them out of the middle of the sidewalk, et cetera, where they'd be lying all over the place?
I think, look, what we would say is, like, treat our bikes like you treat your own bikes. This is a good thing for Seattle. We are making the price points very affordable. Treat our bikes with respect, park it responsibly, park it how you park your own bike, and let's just make bike share work in Seattle.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you use the word responsible, and I think you're absolutely right on that. I mean, the city's guidelines on parking are pretty clear, but the word responsible kind of sums it up. Put it in a space where it's not going to block anybody. It's not going to provide an impediment to travel, whether it's pedestrian travel or car travel. Don't put it somewhere dangerous. Don't put it somewhere in someone's private property that they don't want it. I mean, I think all these things, again, fall into that kind of responsible, you know, thoughtful behavior.
We asked KUOW listeners on Facebook, what would make bike share work better for you? And Camille was not alone in saying, quote, if all the steep hills in Seattle suddenly became flat, you may think your system is better than Pronto, but what can be done about Seattle's geography?
Well, nothing. Thank goodness, because we wouldn't have the views that we have if we didn't have that amazing topography and geography. I think that both of us are working to build a bike that is the best it can be for the city. From a weight perspective, you mentioned the weight of Prontos and lugging those around. Ours are about 20 pounds lighter than the Pronto bikes were, so that is a piece of it. We also have, as I mentioned earlier, an 8-speed in-hub gearing, and we've also worked really hard on the gear ratio to make it so that hills are less daunting. It's not going to take them away, and it's not going to make everyone want to ride up them. Queen Anne Ave will never be a fun ride for a lot of people, but we're trying.
Like Gabriel said, we can't change the topography of the city, but we can do whatever we can to make it easier for riders.
Our views beat Iowa's views.
They're different views.
Different. Not better, not worse, just different. Now, how much of a concern is Seattle's helmet law to either one of you?
Well, like the way we look at it is that we will do everything in our power to require the user to acknowledge they're wearing a helmet, just like how if you go in a car to go, by law, you have to wear a seatbelt, but a car can still start without a seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
So much really following common sense kind of approach to using helmets.
Can bike share work with a helmet law? Because I've seen some bike advocates say, no, that's a problem.
Well, I think you're asking a great point. And I completely second everything Derek just said. I mean, safety is priority for both of us for reasons both human and also business, right? Like, safety is really, really critical. We want people to wear helmets, but ultimately, you're right, we can't put them on them. That said, I think when you talk about whether we can coexist with the helmet law, there's some really interesting questions, and the city is framing this as a pilot. We're both going into this knowing that we operate till the end of the year, assuming we operate by the rules, but the city may end up changing things. And one of the things I'm sure they're watching, and you could ask the city this, but is what does the helmet law mean? And the really cool thing, and I think we both feel this way about this pilot, is the city's going to be collecting through the UW a lot of data on the rides that are being taken, customer service complaints, any kind of accident reports, et cetera. So they're going to be able to make a very different assessment, I think, of safety as relates to bikes. Infrastructure that might be missing or that might be needed, infrastructure that exists and how well it's performing because of the data that this pilot is going to enable. And so to me, that's one of the big pieces that maybe down the line we have to have a different conversation as relates to helmet laws. I think it's responsible and smart to wear a helmet, but maybe that's a different conversation with different kinds of data available.
Final question from Facebook. Roxanne writes, wanting people to rely on bikes in a rainy, hill-filled city is some seriously ableist bullhinky. The idea that a significant part of car use will be replaced by cycling is just not realistic. What do you say to Roxanne, who is not going to give up her four wheels for two or two legs for two or however she does it?
And I would say to that I don't expect everyone to give up four wheels for two. What I would say is that increasingly what we find in Seattle is gridlock all over the place. You go to the Mercer Mess any time of day almost, it's starting to feel backed up. I-5 is starting to look congested almost around the clock. And so to me, we're not going to get everyone out of cars, and we're not trying to. What we're trying to offer is a viable alternative such that when you need to make that trip from Belltown to City Hall, as Derek did yesterday, you have an option. And biking's not for everyone. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-everyone solution, but I think it'll add value to the city in a city that desperately needs more transportation mobility.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, look, Seattle's a growing city. Congestion is getting worse year on year. More cars are coming in, more people coming in. I think the greatest enemy to the development productivity of a city is single car occupancy. And by us offering an alternative to driving, we'll not only provide more options to people, but it also make drives a lot more pleasant. The more people you get off the roads and on cars, the better everything will be.
Derek Coe, co-founder and CEO of Spin, Gabriel Scheer, Director of Strategic Development for Lime Bike. Good luck to you both.
Thanks.
Is it only one bike share can survive, or can you both win?
I mean, Derek mentioned Reach Now and Car2Go earlier. Yep. I don't see any reason why we can't coexist. In fact, we're excited because I think we'll push each other to improve.
Yeah, I think ultimately consumers will win.
Okay, well then maybe you'll exist in tandem.
I'm riding a stolen bike up and down Damon Avenue each night.
Riding a stolen bike. That's exactly what a KOW listener was thinking. Fedora just tweeted to us, I have high hopes for the city's new bike stealing pilot program. Which is a fair question. Fedora, thank you for that. You might wonder about what stops a person from ripping off a bike that somebody left sitting on the sidewalk after their ride. Well, Derek told me nothing actually stops them, but the bikes can sense when they're being moved while they're locked. So the bikes let out a loud, annoying beep, which is meant to deter or scare off the thieves. Both companies' bikes, Lime Bike and Spin, just hit the streets this week. It's a pilot program. City Council is going to watch how those bikes get used. So if you believe in bike share, then you might want to vote with your feet. And please don't steal bicycles. And finally, here's another reaction I'm seeing from a KOW listener on Twitter. Katie tweets, I'll start using a bike share when it comes with a battery, a roof, and body armor. Thanks, Katie. Thanks for tuning in to KOW Seattle and joining us on Twitter at KOW. I'm Bill Radke. This is The Record. Now, let's talk about which researchers you should believe. The Bloomberg headline said, go slow on the $15 minimum wage. The New York Times headline was, Seattle shows the way to higher pay. The stories described two different academic studies of Seattle's rising minimum wage. One of the studies came from University of Washington researchers. The other was from UC Berkeley, and they drew very different conclusions. So what are you supposed to believe? Well, my next guest writes about academic research for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Paul Baskin told me why it is common for two studies on the same topic to turn out differently.
In general, what we see in science is that there's many reasons, from conflicts, from financial conflicts, from personal conflicts, from personal agendas, to measurement issues, terminology issues can sometimes throw people off. And then there's, of course, I mean, there's with human beings, anytime you're trying to measure human beings especially, it's very difficult to try and figure out what people might do in the future. I mean, if you're studying astronomy, for instance, you might look out at the sky and be able to determine that there's going to be an eclipse next month by looking at what's happened before and what's coming up, and that's fairly straightforward. But if you're looking at what human beings are going to do, I mean, you sometimes can't tell what you or somebody else is going to do, you know, in a minute from now, never mind what a whole bunch of people, thousands or millions of people are going to do, you know, in a year or two from now, and how they'll react to a various set of inputs and in stimuli and life events. So to predict something like that is extremely difficult, in addition to all the sort of possible scientific measurement issues that can come into something like this.
You mentioned financial conflict. What about research funding? Because last week, a University of Washington economist study found that a new sports arena in Soto, our Soto neighborhood, would generate more city money than using Key Arena in a different neighborhood. But that study was paid for by the investors in the new Soto arena. How common is that for a researcher, a university researcher, to get money from someone with a clear interest in the outcome?
Very common. I mean, very common. This is a subject of increasing attention. I mean, the fact that somebody is working with a corporate partner should not be dismissed out of hand. As a matter of fact, researchers need to do that, because you have the academic world where people are studying kind of abstract questions, and you have the real world or the corporate world, the industrial world, where people are actually making things that people use and get put into play. So they do have to talk to each other, they do have to work with each other, and that's how you get good results in a lot of cases. At the same time, you're completely right to ask if a financial interest that favors one particular party and that party's paying for the research could affect it. And we see this. It's studied a lot more in things like drug development, where, as a matter of fact, I just wrote about a case just this month where the funding is coming from drug companies, and then the results all suggest using these drugs. And, you know, without being able to evaluate that particular case, which is actually being evaluated by some other scientists, there have been studies that show, in general, when that happens, a drug is more likely to be shown as effective, and the dangers are less likely to be stated when the research is being funded by the company that makes that drug.
Well, given that conflict of interest, why would a public university take money to do research when the money's coming from an interested party?
Well, because why would anybody take money to do work? They take money to do work because that's what they do. If there's real genuine cause to suggest there's a financial conflict is interfering or causing you know, a biased result, then it's basically up to somebody on the other side to look at that and analyze it and point out what the problem is. And that does get done, especially in cases where there's at least an interest on the other side that has the financial capacity to at least compete a little bit, you know, maybe fund its own study, or maybe at least look at that study and go through the numbers and figure out what it is, if anything, that's biasing that conclusion. It gets a little bit trickier in other cases where maybe in a drug case where a drug manufacturer, the patients may not have the financial wherewithal to create their own research study or get their own experts to analyze it. But it would seem that in the case you're talking about in Seattle, there might be the possibility of a financial interest on the other side taking some time and looking at that study and figuring out what, if anything, has gone on in that study to bias it.
In your experience, how common is it for funding from an interested party, how common is it for that funding to affect, to skew the research? Or do you find usually the researchers know how this works and they do their research completely independently?
You know what you're asking, I mean, it gets tricky because it's not just overt bias. There's more subtle biases. One thing that goes on, too, just beside the actual dollars, you know, whether the question is, okay, I'm a researcher, I get paid, you know, whatever, $100,000 by somebody to do a study. Am I going to bias the study to the interest of that person or that entity hiring me, and why would I do it? And you can see an obvious reason why. You want to please them. You want to maybe get them to hire you again in the future. But there's also sort of these intrinsic biases of being a researcher, because you work for a university. You get promoted basically on your publication rates. In articles, when you write about science, articles get published in journals, not necessarily because it's the best science, but although we hope that's the case, in a lot of cases that is, but also because it's maybe an interesting article, it's something that people will pay attention to. There are other biases where maybe you come up with a finding that's a very important finding, but it tends to affirm what's already known, so you don't write about that one. So the literature, the scientific literature, tends to get filled with articles that seem to suggest things are new all the time, whereas maybe, you know, 10 other studies show that it's similar to what we already knew, and instead of getting published results that show, you know, we're really, really sure about something, you tend to get a lot more conflict and uncertainty. So I guess what I'm getting at is there's a lot of different factors that go into why a scientist, who is a human being after all, might tend to overlook something or emphasize one thing and not so much emphasize another, and not necessarily do it, you know, overtly and consciously, but just sort of, you know, goes on sort of in the back of the head. It's a very, very difficult thing to really monitor police and really do anything about, other than to expect that if you set up good systems, that in the long run, the more the science that gets replicated over and over again will tend to prove out. We may get there to an indirect route, and we may certainly have a lot of science that gets published out there that's not true or partially true or in some ways leaves something out or puts too much emphasis on something it shouldn't. But in the end, we get there, and you can see, obviously, the results of overall our scientific wherewithal in this country.
Paul, I like that you're pointing a finger now at my industry. We in the media, we like the new. So that's important for our listeners to know. There's sort of a bias in, hey, you know, good morning, here's something new. So I want to ask you, when we hear in a newscast, a new study finds so-and-so, and we don't know who paid for the study, what do you want us to think?
Well, I'm thinking about, for instance, what you may have seen in the news lately, the story about caffeine. It's just in the last week or so, there's been a series of stories saying that caffeine is good for you, it extends your life, and overall people who drink more coffee do better. So I look at a story like that, and I immediately think, you know, wow, haven't we seen that? And a lot of people think the same thing. Haven't we seen that story or versions of it, you know, 100 times in the past, sometimes saying that coffee is good for you, sometimes not?
So we follow this in Seattle a lot because Starbucks being here. I think we pay extra attention to these studies, and yes, I've seen many.
Yes, absolutely. And so, but what I see over and over again, and just in this past week, I was watching for it, was how many of these reports stop and say, okay, what have the last 10 or 20 articles on caffeine or on coffee told us? And I'm not seeing that, frankly, in a lot of the stories that have come out on this. So that would be the first thing I would expect me as a reporter, somebody as a reader, and frankly a scientist to include. And there is, in fact, a system for that in science, where when you do something like that, you're supposed to do a very careful review of the existing literature and take that into account. Sometimes that's done, and sometimes that's where a bias comes in. If it's funded by industry or whoever it's funded, there may be an incentive to not look at necessarily all the studies and to portray it a certain way, and you certainly have to watch for that.
I've been talking with Paul Baskin, who writes about academic research for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Paul, it sounds like in conclusion, I hear you saying don't dismiss science and don't worship it either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the scientists will tell you that too, for the most part. It's not handed down by the gods to us. It's people doing their level best in most cases to find the answers, to be self-correcting. There are influences out there that can distract them, that can complicate it for them. But in general, they're aiming to learn what they can. And when human beings are involved, studying human beings, that's been harder to really get a definitive answer.
Paul Baskin writes about academic research for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Did you see those headlines that he mentioned, drinking coffee can lead to a longer life? That was about some new government-funded studies. The headline, you won't be shocked to find out, is a bit misleading. These studies show a relationship between coffee and long life, but it certainly doesn't prove that more coffee means you'll live longer. Some coffee studies suggest some benefit. Other studies show some risks to drinking a lot of coffee. I can't go through it all here, so we're going to send you a helpful link. We are tweeting at KUOW. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I am now identifying myself as Bill Radke. Thanks to Microsoft, we now have an iPhone app that can help us identify each other, can help us recognize faces, and whether those faces are happy. The app is called Seeing AI, as in artificial intelligence, and it might be an exciting leap forward in AI. It might be the sentinel of a terrifying dystopian future. GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop's with us. Good to see you again, Todd.
Good to see you, Bill.
Seeing AI, what does it know? How does it know?
So this is a great example of machine learning and artificial intelligence. What the app can do, it can do a variety of things, but the parlor trick of the app is its ability to take a picture of someone, identify their gender, their emotion, their age, and even some facial features. And this app was originally created and actually is intended for people with visual impairments. So it has a variety of tools, channels they're called in the app, that do a variety of different things, such as the ability to scan short blurbs of text and scan documents and read them back, identify different scenes, But this really is a great example of a machine, a computer, replicating human senses. And that is where you start to see the promise of artificial intelligence in something like this, even though it's very simple.
Well, I can imagine how people just walking around could easily upend the gadget's idea of what gender looks like or what even age looks like. Then there's the question of emotion. That seems like another step somehow. That do I want computers identifying human emotion?
It can be a slippery slope. And as I said, this is somewhat simple, although I don't mean to diminish the technology behind it. Obviously, there is tons of work and very advanced machine learning, artificial intelligence that goes into detecting a face. So what Microsoft has done here essentially is trained a model based on a bunch of different pictures that it's taken and fed through its artificial intelligence algorithm to say, okay, an image like this, that is somebody smiling. An image like this, that is a 42-year-old man or whatever it may be. And so then the computer can infer from all of that training when it gets new data. And so that is what the machine learning does, is it sets it up to learn what the images say.
So what's an example of how someone would use this app?
Oh, do you want to try it right now, Bill? I've got it right here. So I have it set up here.
He's aiming the camera at me.
I'm pointing it at you, Bill.
And which I start going into smiling mode because that's when you do when someone's aiming a camera.
That's right. Okay, so let's try it out.
Okay.
Processing. 47-year-old man with brown hair wearing glasses looking happy.
That's way older than when we tested it out earlier, Bill.
47. I'll take that. I'll take that almost 5-year reduction. You know, I was talking to a colleague who also got, it was at least 5 years knocked off her age, which is inaccurate yet clever marketing. Exactly. I do not want the app that says I'm older than I feel.
I believe that they've trained the algorithm to be very careful in erring on the lower side of the age.
Right.
So other things that it can do, scan text, it can do barcode scanning. A feature that's coming soon will be the ability to detect among different variations of currency. So you can put a $5 bill down, a $20 bill down, and it can tell the difference. Now, obviously, that's critical for people who are blind or have other kinds of visual impairments.
Yes.
You know, you can there's the practice of folding bills to make sure that you're pulling out the right one at the register, but you still have to, at some point, know what the bill is to be able to do that.
So this, I know that this talk of dystopian, horrific futures can be a slippery slope thing, and who really knows? But the mind does when you're trying to interpret, when it's computers trying to interpret human emotion, you do get into the 2001 type of territory, a la.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
Hey, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move. This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
So are we looking at a future where AI is going to fight us for survival?
Not in this app.
No. This is the slippery slope I mentioned, but I just want to pick your GeekWire brain about where we're headed.
I am not convinced that we are headed toward HAL. I believe that there is so much concern about this in the minds of engineers, that we as a society, as humanity, are going to ensure that ultimately we have the control. And what you're seeing emerge in the tech industry recently is a real focus on augmentation of artificial intelligence, augmenting human abilities and human knowledge. But human judgment and the ability to draw conclusions from the facts that these machines are coming up with, I think will still remain in the realm of humanity.
Wow, you're really being reassuring to us humans that we should let computers do whatever they want, which suggests that you're probably a cyborg.
Open the pod bay doors.
Todd Bishop, GeekWire, always good to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.
And thank you for tuning in to the radio and for joining us on Twitter at KUOW. I'd love to hear your reaction on Twitter at KUOW to the gadgetry of the now and the future.